This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
This is www.urbanharvest.org. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 Houston.
A clearing Saturday afternoon, Hillcroft at Westheimer, the heart of what I would call Houston's Strip, literally. Though it's of course not the case, it feels as if everyone is either running along the street or ensconced in a 1970s era Harold Farb apartment complex, either doing it or jogging on a treadmill. In truth, many are taking their clothes off for others in the dark, spotlit environs of Baby Dolls, Treasures, Men's Club, and so forth, while the rest run their cars up the vast 10-lane boulevard, popping into various stores and eateries. I sat at a long, red left-hand turn light, a pile of cars in front of me. I don't know why, but it felt good to be there. A carefree American Saturday afternoon in what felt like a relatively carefree place. I spotted a CD on the floor that I hadn't listened to in a long, long time. The Smashing Pumpkins, a 1990s era band that put together some moving aural assaults before self-destructing in personality disputes. I put it on and turned it up loud. A 41-year-old man reliving some past. To younger eyes, I must have looked like a funny joke, but to the newspaper hawker working the intersection, I looked like a customer, and he flashed the day's headline my way. I already knew it, but it still had a weird effect on me, seeing it paraded mundanely along the curb. Big, bold Houston Chronicle hysteria typeface. Saddam executed. I shook my head at him, no paper, and everyone else at the light appeared more interested in getting on with their day, too. Saddam, the boogeyman who invaded the dreams of the entire American political and foreign policy establishment for almost two decades, was dead in a tawdry and violent execution, wherein he was taunted as he may have taunted others who went before him. Revenge was meted out. Justice seems another question entirely. Regardless, Americans on that sunny Sunday, Saturday, drove around seemingly oblivious to the whole matter. After years of hearing from their leaders about the catastrophic dangers that Saddam presented to the entire world, it seems strange to me that the Americans driving Westheimer couldn't be bothered to glue down with CNN for wall-to-wall coverage. Although I can certainly understand if they're dubious and sick of the whole thing. The most interesting thing I've read about Saddam's execution is actually a piece from Josh Marshall that took place and was written prior to the execution. Marshall wrote, "This whole Iraq war endeavor, from the very start, has been about taking tawdry, cheap acts and dressing them up in a papier-mâché grandeur. Phony victory celebrations, ersatz democratization, reconstruction headed up by toadies, con artists and grifters. And this is no different. Hanging Saddam is easy. It's a job for once that these folks can actually see through to completion. So this execution, ironically and pathetically, becomes a stand-in for the failures, incompetence, and general betrayal of country on every other front that President Bush has brought us. Try to dress this up as an Iraqi trial, and it doesn't come close to cutting it. The Iraqis only take possession of him for the final act. Try pretending it's a war crimes trial, but it's just more of the pretend mumbo-jumbo that makes this out to be World War IX, or whatever number it is that they're up to now. The Iraq War has been many things, but for its prime promoters and cheerleaders and now dwindling body of defenders, the war and all its ideological and literary trappings has always been an exercise in moral historical dress-up. For a crew of folks whose times aren't grand enough to live up to their own self-regard and whose imaginations are great enough to make up the difference. This is just more play-acting. These jokers are being dragged kicking and screaming to the realization that the whole thing's a mess and that they're going to be remembered for it, defined by it, for decades and centuries. But before we go, we can hang Saddam. Quite a bit of this was about the president's issues with his dad and the hang-ups he had about finishing Saddam off. So before we go, we can hang the guy as some big cosmic, so there. Marx might say that this was not tragedy, but farce. But I think we need to get way beyond options one and two, even to get close to this one. Again, this is Josh Marshall writing. This is claptrap justice meted out to the former dictator in some puffed-up act of self-justification as the country itself collapses in the hands of the occupying army. This is what we're reduced to, what the president has reduced us to. This is the best we can do. Hang Saddam Hussein, because there's nothing else this president can get right. Josh Marshall, writing a day before the execution, couldn't have scripted a more tawdry spectacle for the real thing had he tried. Saddam was executed in front of cameras, cell phones, and Shiite enemies alternately shouting epithets and praises to God. When famous people die, even by execution, the New York Times publishes an obituary. Neil McFarquhar's New York Times obituary says that Saddam was beaten mercilessly by his own father until the boy left home for good. Recently, my colleagues here at KPFT 90.1 Houston, George Ryder and John McNamara, who host Thresholds, the show that comes right after mine, have been spending a lot of airtime on the subject of the harm one does in disciplining children, including your own, with beatings, spankings, and physical punishment. I've wondered over the past weeks if they've spent too much time on it. But then I thought of Saddam's dad, beating him merciless until the young man left home, and the history that followed. Suddenly, as I thought about Saddam's dad and what his own violence has led to, I realized that George and John have been far ahead of the rest of us, trying each week to get us to understand that violent people are started on violence early, most often by being the subject of it as children. George and John continue to implore us to understand the terrible ongoing lifetime ramifications of hitting your own child. If you need better proof, look no farther than the terrible an ongoing toll the life of Saddam Hussein has taken. Earlier that morning, I had attended my usual Buddhist Saturday morning services. One of the phrases we chant, one of the vows we make, goes as follows. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Sitting at the red light, the hawker's headline staring at me, I wondered sadly, does that apply to Saddam? would I have vowed to save Saddam. And though few others except the Iraqi Sunni population will say it, I will, addressing particularly the spirit of the young man who had finally had enough and left home to escape his violent father. Rest in peace, young Saddam. The Saddam that came later, including all those tangentially connected to him, including his grotesque executioners, and two of our own presidents, both named George Bush, I haven't decided. After all, each of us is a work in progress. Although sometimes you might wonder how some people ever arrived at their notions of progress. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. To the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you this morning. Telephone number here, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We will be taking your calls shortly. Going to do a few news items first. Again, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT is the telephone number here. A pleasure to be with you this morning here in Houston, Texas, broadcasting from the station here at 90.1 KPFT and televised this evening, Channel 17, 6:30 p.m., Houston Media Source, the New Capital Television Show broadcast. If you get Time Warner Cable, I think you will be able to pick up that broadcast. If you don't have cable, you're not able to see it. It's not an advertisement for cable, but it is an advertisement for Houston Media Source, a wonderful community television station. And if any of you have any interest in doing television, you should go down there. You should go. Right, Mark?
Amen.
Amen. I have seen an awful lot, not an awful, a wonderful amount of KPFT 90.1. It's not really a bumper sticker. It's a little square sticker. It's a logo sticker. What do you call it? It's not a bumper sticker. Sticker. I'm seeing them on cars increasingly all over the city. Everywhere. It is, and it's such a great thing because, you know, you pull up, and, you know, here I am, monologues all about driving in my car, and you pull up next to somebody, and they have a 90.1 bumper sticker, and you feel, this person next to me, you know, we share something in common, probably lots of things in common. And so, for those of you who want a sticker and don't have a sticker, if you will, basically, if you'll go and subscribe to the New Capital Show database, I will send you a sticker for your car. www.newcapitalshow.com. I will get one in the mail to you, and you can put it on your car, and then you can drive up to stoplights and be next to somebody with the sticker, and know that you stand for peace and justice, economic integrity, so many of the other things that this station stands for. So many fantastic programs. It's amazing. New Capital Show is just one of many tremendous programs by extremely, extremely accomplished broadcasters. I mean, the wealth of broadcasting knowledge here is staggering. And so I can't say enough. If you are interested in getting a sticker, I will send you a sticker. Just subscribe to the New Capital Show database at newcapitalshow.com. And I will get one off to you. You can put it on your car. We're going to go to a couple of news items. Again, telephone 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, discussing topics that are of interest to you that we talk about every week, whether that's alternative energy, whether that is honest accounting, whether that is politics, foreign policy. We can talk about Saddam if you want. I'd be interested in hearing people's impressions. I know that they've been heard across the station recently, and it's a very conflicted picture, as I indicated in the monologue. Also, Charlie Rose the other night. Charlie Rose comes on awfully late here in Houston on Channel 8, PBS. 11:30 p.m. is when the Charlie Rose Show comes on, but it is a terrific program. Charlie Rose, I think, is really one of the preeminent interviewers in our country. And he had on the other night John Doerr, who is the venture capitalist with Kleiner Perkins, who's been responsible for financing some of our country's best-known companies, Apple Computer among them, Cisco Systems, and the list goes on. And also, let's see, he had on as well, I can't remember, it was John Doerr, Scott McNeely, who was former chairman of Sun Microsystems, and another man I don't know, Mr. Sridhar, who's with a company that is called Bloom Energy. I don't know what they do, but this was a half-hour focused on alternative energy. And so for those of you who are interested in alternative energy, at charlierose.com you can get a rebroadcast of it. I think he only puts it up there for free for a few days, and then you've got to pay 99 cents, but I watched it, and it's really well worth it. These are individuals who will be prime movers and shakers of bringing alternative energy to fruition. And in so many ways, what you see is that a California venture capitalist, someone who is a true capitalist, putting risk capital on the line for new ideas, is very much at odds with our federal government. And that tells you how riven our country has become over this incredibly important issue of energy. Someone like John Doerr, who, by the way, is a graduate of Rice University here in Houston, has a bachelor's in science and engineering, I think, from Rice University, one of Rice's greatest, most illustrious graduates, would find himself both politically and ideologically in opposition with our government on the issue of energy, and is beginning to put his power, which is in the form of venture capital behind companies that will be producing technology to help us escape the trap of energy that we currently find ourselves in. And think about what Mr. Dewar has to compete against. When he puts venture capital into alternative energy, think of all the subsidized companies in traditional forms of energy that he has to compete against. If he's funding a solar-powered company, solar power competes against coal power. And think of all the subsidies, both in terms of what are directly paid to coal companies. We've heard about these programs that the federal government has to produce so-called clean coal, which is a multi-billion dollar farce. Coal companies take this chemical, spray it on coal, pronounce it clean. It's nothing of the kind, and they get billions of dollars of payments. Then there are hidden subsidies, of course. These are costs that coal companies and coal-burning power plants have environmental costs, and they're not forced to pay. So that's another form of a subsidy, both direct payments to companies as well as costs that you don't have to pay. And someone like John Dewar, a great venture capitalist, has to take risk capital and put it into an already risky thing, right? New technology is incredibly risky. New companies are incredibly risky. They don't have cash flows developed yet. They don't have customers developed yet. They may not have products developed yet. And if that's not enough, Mr. Dewar has to compete against the federal treasury, the entire weight and mass of the tax-paying apparatus of our country, which has been hijacked and siphoned off to other energy companies to cover their costs. Why? Because those companies know that if they had to include their real costs, costs of pollution especially, their product and their service would no longer be competitive or as competitive. It would no longer be a slam dunk that we're all burning coal power to light the room if the true costs were accounted for. So someone like John Dewar faces incredible odds. And yet here he is, pushing alternative energy. And it's going to take all of us, because there is a huge, huge mass called the Federal Treasury that we will all have to invest under the current presidential administration. We're going to see what happens when Democrats are sworn in. I think that you're going to see a very different energy profile, policy profile in this country come Inauguration Day, which is just in a couple of weeks. 713-526-5738. Here's something that caught my eye. Trounced at polls, Kansas GOP is still plagued by infighting. Washington Post, December 30th. Party puts ousted official in his opponent's old post. Fiercely anti-abortion Republican Attorney General in Kansas, Phil Klein, lost his re-election bid in November when moderate Republicans voted in droves for Paul Morrison, a longtime Johnson County District Attorney who became a Democrat in hopes of vanquishing Klein. This article goes on to talk about how little Klein got in votes, 4 in 10 votes. Remember the book, What's Wrong with Kansas, that was out a couple of years ago? What's Wrong with Kansas? This is by Thomas Frank. The article, the book got a lot of notoriety. Remember that book? It was basically, the thrust of the book was that people in many parts of the country, especially in the Midwest, in the red states, the so-called red states, were voting against their own economic interests, and that the Republican Party was using these value type issues, whether it's abortion rights or religious issues, and was appealing on those issues because if they appealed on economic issues, they'd have no appeal. Because Republican leadership in this country has been attacking the middle class in this country. Jobs have been going overseas and many other issues. I'm not saying that's exclusively the case. I think there are some decisions that have been made that have helped the middle class economically that have come out of Republican rule. I never say everything is cut and dried like this and everything Republicans have done have harmed the middle class. You should never say everything is totally this or totally that. But by and large, I think on balance, Republican policies have not been helpful. That's my opinion. And Thomas Frank wrote this book talking about the fact that if that's the case, people in the middle class in red states who continue to elect Republicans are voting against their own economic interests. And I think there was some truth to that. And yet, it looks as if Kansas may have woken up. Kansas GOP is still plagued by infighting. My friends, I think that you are seeing the unraveling of the Republican coalition. And I predicted that on this radio show very early in 2002, when I first started on the radio. I said, you know what? They're not going to be able to hold their party together. You have Republicans who believe in honest accounting. You have Republicans who believe in reasonable government. You have Republicans who believe in personal rights and privacy. And they're not going to be able to coexist with Republicans who don't believe in those things. And I said it would take 10 years. What are we? 3 years, 4 years. Texas will be a Democratic state, I think. I do. You guys are laughing. No. It will, I think. 10 years. 10 years. Texas will be electing Democrats at the state level. Meat and the Planet. This is an editorial from the New York Times, December 27th. When you think about the growth of human population over the last century or so, what is the growth of human population over the last century? I think it's gone from about a billion to 6 billion. Maybe even less. Maybe half a billion to 6-7 billion and counting. I think that the population of humans has quintupled, at least. When you think about the growth of human population over the last century or so, it is all too easy to imagine it merely as an increase in the number of humans. But as we multiply, so do all the things associated with us, including our livestock. Remember the editorial I gave a few weeks ago, maybe it was last week, about the white dolphin that went extinct, that has gone extinct in the Yangtze River? And I talked in that editorial about the fact that my little daughter would only be reading about animals. She would only see animals that she was reading about that were domesticated animals. Because we're driving to extinction, elephants and lions and tigers and wild mammals. The only animals that our children are, or maybe in a zoo, but the only animals that will exist if we don't do something, folks, to preserve the last of our wild species, the only animals that are going to be accessible to our children, both in actuality and in mind. Think how important it is to be able to think and understand. Okay, there are real quantities of lions and rhinos and hippos and dolphins of the White River variety in China. What a comfort to know that we have this diversity of species on this planet. But the way it's going, the only animals that are going to be accessible are going to be domesticated animals that have some purpose for humans. And remember how few of those animals there are. Let's go back to Jared Diamond. Let's go back to Guns, Germs, and Steel. All of this is related, friends. The population explosion of humans is related to our domestication of crops and animals that began 10,000 years ago. And the number of animals that are domesticated on this planet out of the total number of large mammals, say there's 150 large mammals, only 13 of them are domesticatable. And what are we humans doing? What we're doing is saying, okay, we're going to keep the 13. The other 137, they're gone. They serve no purpose to us whatsoever. We can't domesticate tigers. You know, maybe Siegfried and Roy can. For their Las Vegas show. But we see even there, it's a little dicey. Right? One of them got attacked. We're going to keep 13 of the large mammals that are domesticatable. Remember Jared Diamond talking about zebras, right? You'd think, okay, a zebra, right? A zebra looks like a horse, kind of acts like a horse, herds. Why can't the zebra be domesticated? Africans have tried to domesticate the zebras for generations. Believe me, they've tried. You don't think they've tried? You don't think Africans would have tried to domesticate the zebra? To pull a plow, to ride into battle, or to ride for transportation, or to, help carry things? They have tried, my friends. You cannot domesticate a zebra. Can't be done. They're dodgy. So 13. That's it. You know, sheep, pigs, goats, cows, reindeer, I think, water buffalo, of course, cows, horses, and so forth. 13. And we are multiplying those things like crazy, of course, right? And here's back to the New York Times. It's easy to imagine the increase in human population merely is an increase in the number of humans. But as we multiply, so do all the things associated with us, including our livestock. At present, there are about 1.5 billion cattle and domestic buffalo, about 1.7 billion sheep and goats. With pigs and poultry, they form a critical part of our enormous biological footprint upon this planet. Our enormous biological footprint. Just how enormous was not really apparent until the publication of a new report called Livestock's Long Shadow by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Consider these numbers. Global livestock grazing and feed production use 30% of the land surface of the planet. Let me give you that number again. Global livestock grazing and feed production use 30% of the land surface of the planet. Livestock, which consume more food than they yield. Let me say that again. Livestock, which consume more food than they yield, also compete directly with humans for water. And the drive to expand grazing land destroys more biologically sensitive terrain, rainforests especially, than anything else. But what is even more striking and alarming is that livestock are responsible for about 18% of the global warming effect, more than transportation's contribution. That's amazing. The culprits are methane, the natural result of bovine digestion. Okay, put in delicately. I mean, everybody gets it, right? Can you use the F word? You can't use the F word? The one that ends with a T? Even that one is a no-no? Gas we're talking about, folks. The culprits are methane, the natural result of bovine digestion, and the nitrogen emitted by manure. Deforestation of grazing land adds to the effect. There are no easy trade-offs when it comes to global warming, such as cutting back on cattle to make room for cars. The human passion for meat is certainly not about to end anytime soon. I'm a carnivore. I admit it. But at least can't we have a society and a government that looks at these trade-offs and tries to address them? Isn't it time for us to look at these trade-offs, to understand these trade-offs? Shouldn't our population be talking about these trade-offs? Am I the only person on radio and television who should be talking about these trade-offs? Shouldn't the local news be talking about these trade-offs? Rather than, you know, the mayhem report?
It's absolutely unsustainable. It will.
Hurdle says it's unsustainable. The more humans, the more livestock we ratchet the thing up, the less tigers, the less white dolphins in the rivers. Folks, we got to think about what kind of planet we want. And there's good news, too. There are companies that are coming along to help deal with this methane problem. I know a young lady who works here in Houston for a company called... I forgot the name. Anyway, they're the folks who sponsor DrivingGreen.com. If you go to DrivingGreen.com, I have this ranch now. I'm driving much more than I used to. I'm guilty as charged of driving much more than I used to. I've got to drive 90 miles each way to get to and from this ranch. Well, I go to this thing called Driving Green. I buy a carbon credit. to offset my emissions. And by buying that credit, there's a seller of a credit. This company is now helping farmers capture methane emissions from livestock and use it for producing energy on their farms for generators. It's a neat solution. But I have to voluntarily go to drivinggreen.com because I have a conscience. Shouldn't our federal government be mandating that when you buy a gallon of gasoline, you're going to pay a surcharge? Of course, to offset the carbon emission. We have no carbon trading in this country right now. Our federal government will not subscribe to Kyoto. Do you remember President Bush at the beginning of his presidency said he didn't like Kyoto? And do you remember what he said he was going to do at the beginning of the presidency? He didn't like Kyoto. Okay, all right. He didn't like Kyoto. What was he going to do? He was going to come up with his own plan that he was going to propose. Folks, there's been nothing. Zero. He hasn't come with any plan to either replace Kyoto or improve Kyoto or some alternative Kyoto. Nothing. Zero. Let's go to the phones. I'm tired of talking. I want to hear from you. Cy's up first. Cy, welcome to New Capital Show.
I love tradable permits, by the way. And Benjamin Franklin, I know you can say this, wrote a book called Fart Proudly. Look it up if you don't believe me.
You said it, Cy.
I did. I take full responsibility.
Of course, they can't fire you.
another great scientist, Sir Isaac Newton, never talked about deceleration or braking when he wrote his three laws of motion. Think about that next time you're sitting at a red light.
Cy, explain what you mean when you say you love tradable credits. Tell people what you like and what we should be able to look forward to from tradable credits.
Well, now there is a problem with it, but I mean it is something that is very interesting. You know, you do have to set a limit. You have to decide, you know, how much carbon or whatever the quote unquote bad is,
so that you have a market. So you have to create the market, as it were.
And then on top of all that, you want groups or individuals or communities or whatnot to buy them up and just, you know, stick those permits in their pockets so that no other company can buy those up. But it's just using the market to increase the amount of technology used to minimize efficiently the outputs of the quote unquote bads.
I believe, and I don't know if you agree, that the function of government, one of the functions of government, should be to enforce the purchase of credits by users. It shouldn't be an option.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the government has to say, okay, if you're a business that has deleterious carbon effects, or you are a consumer who has deleterious carbon effects, part of the charge in your purchase of either the fuel or the car, whatever it is you're going to have to pay a surcharge to offset the emission.
And it's not perfect.
It's not an optional end-all solution.
It's not the golden bullet, but it is one great big step in the right direction. Dude, Leo, I hope you don't keep a diary because I'd feel sorry for the trees. I have one quick technical question, and then I'll get to the meat of my topic.
No. You got to wrap it up here, Cy.
Okay.
We got a whole bunch of calls.
The so-called 100 hours is soon to begin. Now, originally, I thought I understood that, but you know, it seems simple enough, but then Congress changed their work week, and they're starting it here on Thursday. So now I have no idea when the 100 hours will end. Now, I know that it's simply, you know, 4 days and 4 hours, but what do you think when do you think the first 100 hours will be done? I'm kind of guessing mid-February to mid-March.
We'll see, Cy. Thanks for the call.
All right, man. Thanks.
713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. I think Cy is referring to the 100 first 100 hours of the new Congress. And 100's a number. It's arbitrary. You know, we think about why we focus on 100, because we count in base 10, right? I mean, if we counted base 8, you know, what would be 64 would be an interesting number to us. We counted base 10. So 100 is interesting. How did we get to base 10? Is it because of the number of fingers and toes we have? I think it must be. 713-526-5738. This is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you this morning, and it will be a pleasure to be with you this evening at 6:30 p.m. Channel 17 Houston Media Source. Next up is Mark Mark, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Did you call Mark?
Yep, you're Mark, and you're on.
Yesterday, and I think it was yesterday's New York Times either, editorial or article mentioned that real wages...
Turn your radio down, please.
It's off.
Oh.
It's on my cell phone, though.
Oh, okay.
Said real wages went up for the first time in forever, and not just... I don't believe it was just an average, you know, being skewed by the upper end, but actual middle-class wages went up. Did you see that report?
I didn't see the report, but I did see that report came out a few days ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, and I saw it as well, and I need to let me see if I have it here. But I did see something.
My question is, when my conservative friends come to me and say, see, our policies are working, and the rising tide does lift all boats.
They're going to, Mark. That's what they're going to do. I mean, that's what they're reduced to now, is to hanging on little random movements in what we call noise in statistical trends. You know,
right.
we have a statistical trend of declining real wages that's been going for 5 years. Maybe more, but let's call
that's
it.
What I'm curious. Yeah, is this? I mean, you know better than me as to how to assess these numbers. But is this just a statistical blip, or? And they said part of it in this article. Yeah, said it's buying power is going to be, inflation's come down a little bit, gas went down a little bit, and that's part of it. It's not just an increase in purchasing power. It's actual wages went up, which is good. I mean, I don't want to like you said earlier, you don't want to say Republicans have done all bad, and maybe some of their policies have been effective in increasing wages, but I don't know what they would be. I can't think of anything.
Okay, Mark, let me talk about it a little bit. We're going to hang up because your phone's phone's not doing great here. Okay. We have seen, as I have pointed out, real wages come under pressure for the past half decade. What that means, again, just so everyone understands the significance of real wages, if you get a pay raise of 10%, but inflation goes up 15%, you didn't get a pay raise, right? Because the cost of your basic goods and services, your food and your transportation and your heavy capital goods, your laundry machine and your oven, all these things went up 15%, but your pay only went up 10%. So if inflation goes up a lot and your pay raise goes up a little, you got a pay cut. And so what we call real wages is the level of wages after the effect of inflation is taken into account. And we have seen basically a decrease in real wages and pressure on real wages, my understanding of it. I haven't looked at the real numbers in a bit, but it's been a problem here in this country for the past half decade. And that's manifested in the middle class being pressed. Why do we talk about the middle class? Because very rich people, I mean, their needs are so far taken care of that even if they were pressed a little bit, it just wouldn't change much in the utility of their needs. So it tends to impact people who live closer to the margin, which is the middle class. And so we've seen people having, difficulty making payments. And, of course, we've seen rises in the cost of health care tremendously. Last year, we saw a rise in the cost of oil. And we've seen also a slack off in the cost of oil. But the caution here is that one report doesn't make a trend. We may see a new trend that develops, but the trend has been for real wages to be under pressure. And so, conservatives may come and say, okay, see, our policies are working, as Mark correctly points out. You may hear that. Look at the recent report. Things are working. But I'm not so sure that's the case. I don't think things are going to be working until we see a trend turn around. I don't see a trend yet. And I don't think we're going to see real wages increase in this country until we truly get a healthcare system that works, until we get an education system that works, until we get an energy policy that works, until we take our military out of places where we're causing loss of life to our own military and to others, and we're causing huge loss of capital, until we get our ecological systems in balance in this country. You want to see real wages go up, that will cause real wages to go up. That plan, that agenda. Implement those things, I promise you. We'll see real wages go up. We'll see incredible new jobs that are created. You know, not foolish jobs. Really good jobs. Long-term jobs. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host, and let's take Kevin. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Yep, you're on.
Can you hear me all right?
Yep, we can hear you.
Hey, I just wanted to say I liked that last little speech, man. That kind of got me riled up. It sounded good. Everything sounded like I've been wanting to hear that. Just wanted to say thank you.
Good. Thank you, Kevin.
Other than that, I want to talk about that coal mining thing, but first off, I have to say, randomly I picked up the Robert F. Kennedy book, Crimes Against Nature, I think that's what it's called. Randomly last night, I picked it up, and I randomly went to the chapter that talked about King Coal mining.
Yeah.
And I just started reading all that stuff, and I called in because I heard you talk about how all the mining and stuff like that is doing a lot of damage to nature.
People don't know, do they?
See, it's so funny that there's towns out there that their biggest fear is those dams that they build when they strip mine.
Yep.
All the rubble that builds up, they have to build dams sometimes to keep it from from breaking. And some people's biggest fear, and it's funny, is that dam breaking. And there was a story about a kid who goes to sleep at night, and he dreams about ways that they can escape. But what that kid doesn't know is that if that dam ever breaks, there's no escape. There's no time for that landslide. And that's funny. It's just like, I just wanted to say that because I read that last night, and I thought it's something people should hear.
You know, Kevin, I applaud you for picking up that book. It is Crimes Against Nature. It's by Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., who is the great environmentalist. I mean, truly one of this country's leading environmentalists and leading activists.
He's great.
He was here in Houston at the Progressive Forum, the speakers series that is put on, and it's a very good speaker series.
Mm-hmm.
And he appeared with Mayor Bill White. And this was, I think, the inaugural presentation of the Progressive Forum, and he was truly stunning. I was there, and it was an amazing presentation. An extraordinarily passionate man. And
yeah.
I think I would say that, if anything else, what I try to do, and I'm sure that what he tries to do as well, to get people to think about where things come from. Where do things come from? When you turn on your faucet, where is the water coming from? When you turn on electricity and you burn it, where is it coming from? When I come on, I'm just trying to get, really, that's all I'm trying to do, is to get people to think where things come from. Because if you think about those things, you'll become more sensitive to it. You'll use less of it. You'll understand. You'll understand that it's not just wrapped up in a dollar bill. Oh, I pay my dollar, I get my water, and I don't have to think about it. If we had a system whereby things were properly costed, yeah, okay, that might work. But we don't have that system right now. If we can get to that system, we can all go back to sleep and pay our bills, and the price will be right. But the price isn't right now. Until the government establishes mechanisms so that proper prices ensue in our country, which is one of the biggest problems that we face right now, is that our prices aren't right. Until the government creates a system, I don't want to say creates a system. I want to say tunes the current system, let's say, makes reforms to the current system so that the right prices are included. We're all going to have to think about where things come from, right? Here in the city of Houston, recycling is not mandatory, right? How do you make something mandatory? It's hard. Well, you do it through price controls. And so I had on the New Capital Show, I had the entire leadership of Mayor White's environmental group, and they were talking about their new effort on the recycling program. And I applaud them for trying to publicize recycling here in Houston. But you know what? You want to get people to recycle real quick in this city? Charge three different prices for three different sizes of garbage containers. You've got a small garbage container, a medium-sized garbage container, and a large garbage container. So if you're going to produce an awful lot of garbage, and you don't feel like recycling, and you want to put all what should be a recyclable into the garbage can, you're going to have to pay a higher price for the bigger garbage can. And those of us who are trying to recycle as much as we can get by on the small garbage can. And make the price differential between these things meaningful. You're going to pay $1,000 a year for the big garbage can. You're going to pay $200 a year for the little one. Believe me, you will get everybody in this city recycling. Why? Because You have to have prices that communicate. And if we don't have prices, then we have to have consciousness. You have to one or the other. Preferably both. But you have to have one or the other. We got neither right now. We don't have the right prices, and we don't have consciousness. You have to have one or the other. Or you've got, or as Pirtle points out, an unsustainable system. Humans are naturally going to react to the signals that their government sends them. We're just humans. And it's not our fault. It's our government. But you know what? We select our government. Although I know I'll get plenty of argument about that here at KPFT. But I'm just trying to make a point. 713-526-5738. It's the New Capital Show. Next up is Tom. Tom, welcome.
Hey, Leo. Good show.
Thank you.
Just a logistical complaint sort of here. I'm up in northwest Houston. I get Time Warner Cable, but Channel 17 is a 24-hour shopping channel. And I don't know what we got to do to lobby Time Warner to change the lineup so we get the Houston Media Source or whatever it is that you're broadcasting. I'd like to see your show, but have not been able to just because Time Warner's not making it available out here.
What do we got to do, Mark?
Well, it's only available in the city of Houston. And the best you can do is ask your cable company for it, but really, or ask your local governing facility to negotiate for it when they do a franchise with the cable company.
Tom, you know, I guess we do what we do as consumers. We call up and we make a demand, and I think if you make a call and some others make a call and say, we want Houston Media Source, and we want it up here, then they'll get it if enough people do demand it. So that's good. We're trying to put programming on Houston Media Source that causes people to want it and want local programming because community television is important, just like community radio. You know?
Right. Well, you do a good job, Leo.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for all you're doing. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Tom. Appreciate the call. Next up is Bill. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I want to first applaud you for putting a price tag on saving our world. I think it's something that gets forgotten, you know, that we aren't paying for what we ought to be paying for. But also, you talked about the Progressive Forum Speaker Bureau, and I saw a speaker there a few months back, E.O. Wilson.
Sure.
And what a great program he's got going. His book, The Creation, he talks about.
Tell everybody, Bill, real quick, who E.O. Wilson is.
E.O. Wilson is the preeminent biologist and entomologist in the world today from Harvard. He was a professor in Harvard, but he has on a mission to enlist the help of all of our religious leaders in saving our planet.
And yes.
He maintains that he will. If he can get them, they have such a knack for communicating with people and
they
reaching
do.
Everybody that why not carry that message too?
It's a wonder. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing I've mentioned recently that I think is happening, which is that the clergy in this country is coming to environmental consciousness. It's dynamic. It's fantastic. You know, I'd like to see someone like Joel Osteen just pick up the cause in the same way that Tom Friedman has. You know, Tom Friedman at the New York Times has gone green, and he started to go green about a year ago. He's late. You know, he's real late, frankly. Tom Friedman should have been writing about going green right after 9/11. He couldn't see that. He couldn't see that deeply then. That's okay. We come to things when we come to them.
That's, you're really right about that.
I came when I came to my understandings. We all come when we come. Tom Friedman came to green a year ago. I would love to see Joel Osteen come to green and start to convey to his parishioners, in addition, that they can come to their own self-fulfillment and self-realization and happiness through helping the planet. He will. I know he'll get there, you know? And maybe even George W. Bush will get there at some point. He's not going to be in office, probably, but he may get there, too. We can all get there. It's a great story of hope. And and what you saw with E.O. Wilson is a great story of hope from him. You know, E.O. Wilson says, you think it's our planet. You may think it's our planet as humans. It's not. It's the bugs. The bugs own the planet. Let me tell you something.
Oh,
the
yeah.
bugs own the planet. There would be no decomposition. There would be no decay. Think if nothing ever decayed in this country. I mean, this world. Think if things didn't decay in the world. It would just pile up like It's a bug's world, and E.O. Wilson makes that point. But he says, you know
and,
what?
And he's got another book, an earlier book called Ants. You know, he was the technical advisor on that movie, Ants.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible, incredible book.
Yeah. Bill, thank you for the call.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Christine. Christine, welcome to the show.
Hi. Great show today. I love the recycling and environment cause. And I was just calling in regards to the mining you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that a lot of people don't think about is also metal mining and also where the jewelry they're buying is coming from. Gold, silver, diamonds, you name it. And
Christine, gold mining is devastating. Gold mining, it uses a cyanide leaching. Imagine leaching an entire mountain with cyanide. Gold mining is an incredibly, incredibly destructive. There's that new movie out called Blood Diamond, I think, which is about diamond mining. Diamond mining is not as destructive as gold mining, but it's plenty destructive.
Exactly. And there's only one place out there that I know of on the line. It's called Green Carrot that's actually making recycled jewelry.
Yes, although individuals are starting to take action themselves and reuse jewelry, and many couples who are environmentally conscious are saying to each other, we will only give each other rings and jewelry that is recycled and environmental. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Here's an article. Thanks for the call, Christine. Here's an article, Fighting Over Gold in the Land of Dracula. This is in Romania. Eugen David, a small-time farmer with a chipped tooth and muddy boots in this obscure wrinkle of Transylvania, is an unlikely man to attract the attention of movie stars and moguls, but he counts Vanessa Redgrave, George Soros, and Ted Goldsmith among his backers in a battle over land with a Canadian gold mining company. In this article in the New York Times, if you want a copy of it, just email me at newcapitalshow.com. I'll send it to you January 3rd. This is yesterday, actually. The company Gabriel Resources owns the rights to mine the hills in Transylvania and wants Mr. David to leave his 50 acres of land so the company can carve out what would be Europe's largest open-pit gold mine. Mr. David says he is not budging. He is not budging. We've got time for one quick last phone call. It's going to be Saeed, and that's going to do it. Johnny and Rusty, I'm sorry, we'll get to you next week. Saeed, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Real quickly, I just wanted to comment, not to be a doomsayer or, you know, to put, you know, dash anyone's hopes, but, you know, the things that you're saying, of course they make sense, and they appeal to people's intellect and appeal to people's consciousness. The problem is, until you put an economic cost to these things, it'll always be, it seems to me intuitively, it's always cheaper, for example, to do things the way they are now. As long as profit is going to be the motive, not stewardship, not responsibility, it'll always be cheaper to use these materials.
That's right, Saeed, but they're one and the same. As I've always said, if you overall undertake a project and you deplete more capital than you create, then you've done something that's not good. You've undertaken a project that's uneconomical. And in time, we will adopt that viewpoint. That's what the show is dedicated to, and that's what many others in the world are bringing themselves to understand. And so don't say doom. Be hopeful. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
This has been another edition of the New Capital Show. The show is produced here at the station by Michael Dumont, and the television production, Mark Pirtle of Houston Media Source. I want to thank all of you for joining me. It's been a pleasure to be with you here. I will be back. Whoop. I'll be back next week with you for another edition of the show. Until then, take care. Be well.
Black holes, parallel universes, DNA cloning, nuclear power, life in outer space, global warming, and Star Wars. These are just some of the fascinating topics that we cover in an exciting new program on science and the environment called Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York and host of Explorations, inviting you to join us every week on KPFT-FM. Expand your mind.
Explorations airs Thursdays at 1, right here on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Media consolidation. It's one of this millennium's emergent issues. What you hear, what you watch, what you have access to online, and ultimately where your dollars go, are all key questions. So join us this January 12th through the 14th with Bill Moyers, Amy Goodman, Jesse Jackson, and Jane Fonda, as well as thousands of others who converge on Memphis, Tennessee at this year's National Conference for Media Reform. I'm Mitch Jezerich with Pacifica Radio, and we're inviting you to this historic event where we'll bring you diverse voices representing the grassroots and beyond, and interviews with people making a difference on an issue that will affect us for generations to come. Again, it's this January 12th through the 14th for Pacifica Radio's coverage of the National Conference for Media Reform.
KPFT will broadcast the Friday morning Bill Moyers opening speech at 10 a.m. We'll also broadcast the Saturday night plenary starting at 8 p.m. and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.